are familiar with this project. Many of you knew both Ted Fagan and Bill Morin, who began this project over 40 years ago. Bill did a presentation, I believe it was at the 1976 ARS conference, sort of an update on what was going on with the discography. So here we are 30 years later, different conference, but same topic. And what we're trying to tell you today is what is going on with the encyclopedic discography of Victor Recordings. Just as a kind of a historical background, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, two young record collectors, by young, I mean about my age, got in touch. Ted Fagan, who is the chief translator for the United Nations in New York City, and Bill Morin, who was a petroleum geologist who lived in the suburbs of Los Angeles. And their passion was opera, and in particular, they both shared a deep interest in the early operatic singers who recorded for the Victor Talking Machine Company in the first part of the century. They started a correspondence, trading information about the material that was recorded on Victor Records and the singers that they loved, the alternate takes, all the kind of weird stuff that went on, trying to sort of untangle the web and figure out exactly all of the intricacies of the output of Victor. This eventually turned into an effort to gather data on the output of the Victor Talking Machine Company. And in 1966, they were given very liberal access to the archives, to the Victor archives in New York City. And at that point, Ted Fagan, who worked at the United Nations, would go to the archives. This is sort of all apocryphal at this point. If anybody has more accurate information, be sure to share it with us. But our understanding of the story is that Ted then began borrowing the ledgers, the blue history cards, and the other documentation that was maintained at the Victor Archives in New York, and taking it to his office, which happened to be the translating booth at the United Nations, and when he wasn't doing simultaneous translations from Portuguese to English or Spanish to English and back, he was busily taking the ledgers and then typing up that information into a format that would become the Victor discography. And I don't know exactly how many years he did that for, when he started and when he completed, but he eventually copied the bulk of the discographic data from Victor's start in 1901 to around between 1950 and 1955, when Victor stopped recording on 70 RPM and moved to tape. And the Bill's role in this then was taking this data that had been collected, and he began editing by comparing the entries to the printed Victor catalogs to verify performers' names. He also compare them to disc copies to find out further information and flesh out the data that Ted had collected from the Victor archives. This went on for a number of years, and in 1983, as most of you know, volume one of the Encyclopedic Discography of Victor Recordings was published by Greenwood Press, and this was the Pre-Matrix series, which Pre-Matrix was really a made-up name, but it was the recordings that were made before Victor switched numbering systems. And then in 1986, volume two was published, and this was Matrix 1 through Matrix 4,999. The projected total scope of this project was roughly to be about 30 to 35 printed volumes, discographies, each covering, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years of Victor's history. And they were projected to look much like the original books, with the information that you see on the recording date, the takes, and the like. Unfortunately, Ted died unexpectedly in 1987. And at that point, the project, either shortly before that or around that time, the project had become affiliated with Stanford University's Archive of Recorded Sound, which Bill had helped found back in 1958. Bill was a Stanford alum. At Stanford, the editorial process continued under the direction of Bill and Richard Kaprowski, who is the assistant archivist at Stanford University's ARS at the time. We believe the early 1990s, a transition was made where the binders that had been created with all of the typed information that were sent overseas, and this was all keyed in by, we think it was done in India. It was all keyed into a database so that they could start to work with the files electronically. The editorial work continued at Stanford from 1987 until 2003. And they were, in preparation was volume 3, which was also to be published by Greenwood Press. And as you all know, it was never published. In the spring and summer of 2003, I had been in touch with Bill for several years at that point, and his health was declining rapidly at that point. Bill had made a commitment after to TED, and I think an emotional commitment as well, to ensure that the project was eventually completed. Bill approached UC Santa Barbara in the summer of 2003 and asked us if we would take over the project. After some arm twisting, we agreed that we would take over the project. And in August of 2003, the database that had been created at Stanford University Libraries was transferred from Stanford to UC Santa Barbara, and all of the document, all the support materials, the logbooks and things like that were transferred as well. My first task as the newly sort of appointed project director of this was to find somebody that actually knew something about discography and see if they could help. So, in the middle of 2003, I approached Tim Brooks and Sam Berlofsky to be on an editorial board for the project so we could give the project direction and steer it in the proper direction and see it to completion. I had known Bill for a number of years, and I had made a commitment to him as well, never spoken, but implicit that I would see the project through to completion. Then in October of 2003, Tim came down from New York, and I happened to be in Washington for something, and we all met in Sam's living room and spent an afternoon looking through the data files, looking through some of the ledgers, looking through some of the books and reviewing notes, trying to figure out what we were going to do with this project and how we were going to make it work. The first thing we did was we decided we would kill the publication of Volume 3. Volume 3, which I've mentioned, turned out not to be Volume 3 in the sense of being 1908 to 1912 or something like that. Volume 3 was an index to the acoustic era, which would have cross-referenced matrix numbers and catalog numbers. Our feeling was that if that was the next volume published, everybody would feel, I waited 15 years for this. So we decided that even though that book had been completed, that we would not publish it. And we also decided at that point that this would not be a print publication project. There may be, but our plan is not to publish print volumes of this discography. It'll be an online database that'll be freely available. So we killed Volume 3 and decided that we would work from a database format. Then in November of 2003, we began the migration project. I hired a database firm in New York City called Properly Sorted Database Solutions, and they began migrating the file from Oracle, which is what it had been at Stanford, to FileMaker, which was a database that I was familiar with and we used at UC Santa Barbara for other projects. And so actually the next year, there were several things simultaneously going on, but my big task over that next year was overseeing the migration of the data from Oracle to FileMaker and working with our programmers in New York who were doing that work. And then in the winter of 2003 and 2004, we began the process of interviewing to hire an editor for the position. We put out a job announcement and interviewed several people, and as it turns out, we ended up hiring Sam on the editorial board, and he had to resign from the editorial board from that. He had expressed interest in taking early retirement from the Library of Congress to pursue other activities, and we were very fortunate to be able to hire him. Then Sam started in June of 2005, so he's been on the project a little over a year, and we began starting to edit the database in earnest, and we also hired at that point an editorial assistant who works from Santa Barbara doing research, verifying ledgers and things like that. So that's where we're at now. I mean, we've got the basic work done in terms of migrating the data, creating the database. We have the programmers in New York who can create editing tools for us to simplify the editorial process. And now we're into the detailed and hopefully not too long, but it will be a long process of editing the data before we can release it online. And I'm going to turn it over to Sam now, who's going to tell you a little bit about the methodologies that are being used to edit the data and where we can see this going in the next few years.
Thank you. I'm going to move this microphone. David said he was looking for someone who knew discography, and I said, I know bureaucracy. And he misunderstood me and hired me, so it was wonderful. And we're going to try to juggle some PowerPoint slides of almost all photos after the first couple slides with actual examples from the database. You're seeing the real database on David's computer, which I don't use, so we'll see how this goes. In any case, David talked about how they converted this from Oracle to FileMaker, FileMaker being a personal computer, actually originally an Apple program, and it's wonderful. The FileMaker is working fine, and I mean, what's most important about it to us is that, you know, it's a custom application that's made generally to our specifications, but it's very adaptable, and David has a programmer on staff or on retainer, and I can call him and bug him and say, I need this change, and I get it very quickly. So what I want to do is sort of show you the database, and then we'll go back and look at some pictures, and I hope I can find the database here, David. That little X, okay. That's our main screen, and please keep in mind, you're seeing the input screens. You're not seeing any kind of reports whatsoever. They haven't been created yet. There's a sort of a model report that we're going to start with. But I just thought I'd show you. We're going to go to matrix detail. And when you do that, you see the very first record. And all of us who work on it, oh, yeah, you don't see the first record. You see something that, how did that come up? Anyway, that was funny. You must have been there already. Then when you can't find things, you try to type right and hope that it's just the find that you typed wrong and not the actual inputting. I'm going to show you a Sousa Ban record and use that as an example of, I guess I'm not going to show you a Sousa Ban record, of some of the aspects of the database. And the database itself is a relational database of three major parts, but many, many, many tables. And I hope you can see, and I'm not going to dwell that much on the structure of the database, but I do want to dwell on what the parts are. Sort of the parent part is the matrix number itself. There is a database record for every master. Tied to the masters are down here, if you can see my arrow where it says matrix detail, are all the talent or all the names that are attached to that master. They might be composers, they might be performers, they might be producers, and they could be lots of things. And then finally, down here is yet another major set of tables attached to the matrix, which are takes, you know, individual takes in which we have made one line for each take and additional lines for when objects or actual disks, we call them objects, release, you know, result from those takes. So if you look at this, this is the Sousa Ban. I use this record because it's complicated. It shows a lot of things, but it's a Sousa Ban recording of Washington Post. I'm not that good on this computer, but you can see the first time that Sousa Ban went in and recorded it was August 18th, and if you look at the bottom of the screen, it goes, you see it down to 1912, and if I sort of do this view, you can see there are even acoustic recordings of Washington Post March up until 1923. But I really want you to get that concept of the three major pieces of the database. That is to say, the master, the talent associated with it, the takes. So what is it that I do all day? And that's what I'm going to try to explain to you and sort of show you some of the problems we've encountered, some of the opportunities. You know, I used to work at the Library of Congress. I had to wear a tie every day, and I don't do that anymore. So I, you know, get dressed in the morning and go to my office where I work all alone. But it's very important that I have a uniform. And it's also very cold up here. So to get in the proper Eldridge Johnson mood, every morning I keep this. I have about 7 or 8 of these. And I mess up my hair. I don't have to worry about my hair. Thank you. I'm just grateful to have hair, you know. It doesn't matter. One of the things that David talked about was the actual, what Ted did, and we don't necessarily know what Ted did, as David said. We do have some good documentation that Bill Moran left and wrote to Stanford, and I actually typed it out verbatim what Bill wrote. And what he says in this slide, I'll give you a chance to read while I gab on, is that basically, as David told you, Ted had this incredible opportunity to take these original files over to the United Nations. And by the way, unlike many collectors, Ted returned them all and typed them all out, and then probably on cards, and then made typewritten sheets. And then at some point, he made copies of the sheets and shared them with Bill. And what he says in this slide, and I'm not going to read you these slides, is that Then they were input into a database, and there was sort of they call it a word processing database. I think it was, what was it?
Anyway,
Multimate, something that doesn't exist any longer. The disks are 5-inch floppy disks. I mean, you know, and then Ted and Bill exchanged copies, and then they both marked up the copies. And so at Santa Barbara, they're actually, our editors there are using both sets of copies. This, which is very difficult to read, is a Multimate printout of 1904 sessions. I don't know if you can read it with Collins and Harlan. That's a nice example for a lot of reasons. I'm going to come back to it a few times. One of them is that if you go all the way over here to the right, you see that the recording says it was this written in red, made with organ. The PF, or pianoforte, is crossed out. But then, just to keep us on our toes, over here on the right, someone's written PF. And that's the problem. I mean, the one thing about this, and this is true of any discography or most databases, this work is never going to be complete. And David's job as the project director and mine as the manager sort of, in part, to figure out, you know, when to let go, when to move on, so that there will be a volume 3 in our lifetime. We hope that. And we hope it's going to be soon. But when you deal with conflicting data and you don't know what the provenance is, it's very difficult. I'm going to just randomly go through some records here. And this is just to show you, these are all, I don't know how to use the Apple. But I'm going to show you another specific record, because I have some specific records to show you specific things that we've encountered, and then I also want to go over some of the resources that we use. And I'm sort of typing a matrix number into the index, hopefully correctly. And you see that this is Eyes of Blue by Catherine Maisel. And this is sort of an interesting record, because this is sort of how we got it. If you look down here in takes, they're all sort of concatenated. You see there's 1 through 6 over here on the right. If I click on this status, you see DMDDH. The first one was destroyed, the second one was mastered, the third destroyed, fourth destroyed, fifth destroyed, and the sixth was held. Over here, OB, we figured out means orchestra recorded by, led by Rosario Borden. And we have done some sort of macro, some global changes to take that OB and add the orchestra up here and add his name. Catherine Maisel's name I've gotten, and I'm going to go into that a little bit. One of the things that's interesting is, you know, orth. This is an orthophonic disc or something. I didn't know what orth was, but we were able to determine that orth is indeed a composer, and we want to add that composer orth to this record. I'm going to see if I can show you how we might do that, and let's see what I have here. This is more of that particular Collins and Harlan. By the way, this particular, this is Ted's manuscript, and this is the way volume two of the book looks, and won't go into that. They're incredible resources in Victor, and I have to, you know, we like to sit in our and trash the record companies, but I'm actually really impressed by the amount of documentation that's been retained, in particular by Victor and Columbia. Dick and I often talk about when Dick was doing his bicentennial anthology of folk music, going to Decca and saying we'd like to license these recordings, and they go, we don't own those recordings. They didn't even know what was theirs, much less have documentation. In this case, Victor kept ledgers and then what they call infamous blue history cards. This is a lousy little picture one that I took, in which a blue history card represents a specific disc. And this is probably, you see, it says Eyes of Blue, the opus number, the alto's name, orchestra, the names of the lyricist and composer, who's R.E. Orth, and the publisher, and some information about what disc it was issued on and when it was when it went in and out of print. Sometimes. In our case, what I, and there's the back of the Blue History Card, again, a very lousy photo of mine, where they often, not always, actually reproduce the label on the backs of Blue History Cards. I would guess Victor has 200,000 to 300,000 of these Blue History Cards for every release, because if you sort, we have 150,000 masters in this database. A master could result in many different discs, as you know, and they would make a Blue History Card for each disc they issued. Pardon me? Each side, yeah. So it's more than 300,000. For that reason, we don't have that much access to them without going up to New York. Over here, I just wanted to show you, this is a relational database. The database record for Catherine Maisel, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right, is there's only one for her for each role she takes. And we have the opportunity to designate what her role is, vocalist, and a subtype for instrumentalists. It might be what instrument they play. Here, it's the range of her voice. She's supposedly an alto. Well, what do I know about her, and how do I know about it? And this is part of the theme of our talk, is the fact of the great resources that we have. In order to be consistent within the database, we want to spell each name one way and be consistent, and we make use of any authority we can find. In this case, it's an online authority, which is the Library of Congress Name Authority Database, to which libraries across the country contribute. This one, they tell you how they spell her name. They give her birth and death dates, which I would have put in her record, but I'm not going to do now. It also tells me she's an alto. I didn't know that. The label didn't necessarily tell me that. I want to show you another one, and let's go back here. I mentioned the concatenated takes, and I really don't want to go through the process of splitting all these up for you, but I'll show you another record. Let's go back to that Sousa record, if I can get to it. And I should have opened another window, but I think now, whoops, that's not the way to do it. Something that Ted did, and of course Ted made a lot of decisions here, and they were good decisions, but sometimes they make odd database records. Here, as I showed you for the Sousa record, it goes to 1923, but if you know this recording at all, you know that it actually came out for longer than that. If I can, how do I do that, David?
What do you want to do?
I want to get to the next record. There we go. So there's the same matrix number, but with a different prefix, of Victor Electric recording of Washington Post March. And here you see that it was recorded again in 1926. I want to point out some things we've also done, going back to the other record. The Sousa is a good example. You're going to see lots of different things we did with Sousa. One is that Sousa had a lot of... you know, as they were re-recorded, and it's very well known that for the most part, Sousa was not present in any recording sessions of the Sousa band. He blessed the masters and cashed the checks. And in this case, we do want to try to trace who the conductors were, any information we know about each take. So that's why you see four different conductors here. The display on this input screen is somewhat random. I've never figured it out. So you see Walter Rogers of takes 6 to 9, Pryor 1, 2, 10 and 11, et cetera, and then Shilkret and Clark. So we're able to trace all those, and when you see the actual disc and know what take it comes from, you can extrapolate, you know, who the conductor is. David mentioned that we have official advisors. Richard Green and Tim Brooks have provided a lot of guidance on basically of, you know, helping me, you know, let go, you know, what to concentrate on, what to let go of, what our publications should look like and things. But people are just, everyone is helping. And we've just been great beneficiaries of the generosity of the scholars who deal with these. I want to show you some of the problems we've encountered. I'm going to go to 1968, is it? Oops, and I have to see, this is, if there are problems, it's mostly age or dyslexia or something. And you see there are nine because it searches only for the, it searches for anything with that string. Maybe I can get to it. Krausmeier and his dog Schneider, one of our favorite records. And it's sort of nice because we opened with a cat recording and we're not going to play any recording for you. In any case, here you see an example of one thing is over here on the right with what we call the legacy data. Schneider is, the label actually says Krausmeier and his dog, and Schneider over here is in parentheses. So we look at catalogs to see, is that Schneider a composer? Is it an author? Is it, you know, what is it? For a misspelling of Schnauzer? We don't know what it is. Spencer, in parentheses, we've learned to know that Spencer is the author. That's sort of the way they do composers and authors. Hans, I have no idea what Hans means, and that's something that, you know, one day we'll know. Maybe one of you know. So we have a way of marking main talent, which is Spencer and Holt, and then we add an entry for Spencer as the author. Over down at the bottom, you see that there are two issues that we have noted, the single-sided 10-inch, and then down here, Victor 17255. And we can go to that record and see what the other side is, but we can't go to that record and see the other side. I might add we have a lot of drop-downs. I can go to this record and mark it as a black label because those of you who collect Red Seals know that there's similar numbers for Red Seals, so we have to differentiate the different 17255s. So we don't know what the other side of it is. So this is where we use the catalogs. This is where we go to the catalogs and we look and see what the other side was. And we go to the catalogs and they tell us the title, but they don't tell us the matrix number. But we're grateful because we have, and by the way, if I go to the book, whoops, oh, I'm out of order. I have to go back to that. If you go to the book, just to make sure we have it, you know, I learned that the other side was closing time at Country Grocery. You see, 1018, it would be B 1018 maybe, but there was no double face record listed there. So that's an error in volume two. If you brought your copies with you, you might mark them now. And how are we for time? Oh, good. Okay. So here, I don't know. I have sort of, I think I know what the other side is, but I don't know what matrix is. I might be able to do. So what resources do I do? Well, I write to John Bolick. I mean, it's very simple. I'm not stupid, and I know what I don't know. And it was absolutely while I was preparing the talk that I sort of encountered this, because I didn't show you this. We have a little internal messaging system where the editors in California can write me, and we can write back to each other to do. So I sort of made a guess that it probably is 1018, but I couldn't be sure. I didn't know what take it was. And John wrote me back and said, yes, indeed, it is 1018, and it's take two, because John has, John for a few years camped out at BMG, and I think his cot is still up there. And here's, in this case, John told me that it's take two. Well, you see, I have it as take one from 1728, but we're very good at covering ourselves with footnotes. And if you go up here, we didn't know which was the issue take one or two. So was that 17255? I don't remember. But anyway, just to show you how I might add that, maybe I can do this. I would duplicate this one because it would give me the date. I can now, because John has told me this is take two, I can make that take two. I can make this take two because we know that the double face is from take two. I can make this take one. And then our programmer has given us a nice little thing. If we put in numbers here, we can reorder the display. So now I have 1728. Well, it's actually wrong because 17 should be first. And I think that was 17255. Anyone remember? Anyone paying attention? And I can reassign that. And now when I look at the object, I can see Krausmeier in closing time. I mean, this is David's copy. We'd have to go back and do that. I'm going to show you some other things that, we encounter. Having only one side of a disc is a very common problem. There's another problem that we have, which is having things which are not in the database at all. Our goal is to document every single Victor disc that came out, but we're providing details on those that were recorded in the United States, but we really want to get everything in here. And this one isn't what I want, but here it is again. This is a good example. This is where one of the technicians in Santa Barbara wrote a note and says, "We're missing the First Kiss waltz." She looked in the catalog and found that 16488, of course, it's a double-sided record, and there was only one entry here. And she said, "Well, it's First Kiss waltz." So we go up here and we search titles. We can't find First Kiss waltz. And to make a long story short, again, having a wonderful resource, we find that Alan Kelly, who's so ably and thoroughly documented gramophone releases, has indeed documented a disc that's called, somewhere here, Primo Baccio and Walzer. So we will go back and we will enter that. I'm not going to do it now. We'll call it GR9200 over here. Hopefully get the dates right and not call it, and know that it's the 19th of November, 1908, and we'll make an entry of that. We will not enter all these different gramophone or xylophone releases in this database, hoping that Charm is going to do that next year. And we've talked to each other and hope that we can indeed communicate with each other. But that's just sort of, as I say, there are a lot of resources we use. David Giovannone's been so generous with the incredible documentation he's done of the pre-Matrix series, particularly of the Monarchs and Victor. I actually will stand up and attest that indeed Rigler Deutsch is a very good resource, because despite the misspellings, you can see how titles are phrased. And we go to Rigler Deutsch and we're able to look and see what the title was called. And then sometimes I just have to look at a record and it's discouraged sometimes I just have to do it, so I call David and he pulls a record for me. But that's another resource. We were really lucky that Victor was so generous with their ledgers. And this is half of the Victor daily ledgers, not the blue history cards. This fine archival shelving is not from Santa Barbara or the Library of Congress. These are Victor's ledgers. On the bottom shelf, you sort of see the large ledgers that are by artist that predate 1911. And then at the top, in these sort of postbound things, are about, as I recall, 9,000 pages of individual records. And I want to show you one. I had it out of order here. I'm sorry. There's one, and I guess this is hard to read, but it's Waring's Pennsylvanians. You can see what the titles were. These are the recordings of May 22nd, 1929. If you look all the way on the left, you see it starts with take six. So takes one through five are on other pages. If I were to do this and edit this, I would go into the database and sort of look and see what is the exact spelling of that song. What was the one? To Be in Love, Especially for You. If you can see where my cursor is, it's spelled very odd. And how do I do that? Sometimes it's just a real dumb search. You just sort of search it in Google. Not that the web is so authoritative, but if you see four or five ways where it's espech, if you see there, E-S-P-E-C-H, apostrophe L-L-Y, it's there, and it's there again. It's sort of like, well, that's four or five times. It's just the difference of the C and the S. That's probably the way it is. I mean, we would also look at the catalog, too. And we would look at the actual recordings, either at Santa Barbara or through catalogs. One of the nice things we're able to do with this is, at the advice of our advisors, Richard and Tim, we really want to be sure of the provenance of our data. So here, we're marking where we have these things. And we mark who we steal from: Kelly, Bolig, Volume 1, the Red Seal, Bolig Gems. Maybe for a title, we might take it off an Edison Cylinder, Richard Norton's Broadway Song Guide, Emore, Rigler Deutsch, Gus Mead, etc. And we're able to mark where we got that title. I'll just say disc label. And then, in many cases, I'm not going through this, we have many different titles. We have alternative titles, subtitles, uniform titles, which we pull from OCLC. If we want to sort of set up a uniform title, but it's not officially in OCLC, we might call it, we'll call it a normalized title, you see over here. We also might have a minstrel recording that has three or four or five or six medley contents, and we don't trace those individually, but what we do is we'll mark them, separate them by semicolons, and those would be medley contents, things like that. I'd like to show off, I mean, one of the things that David and I get a big kick out of is just the incredible variety of what Victor recorded, and I think that actually this morning you got a wonderful picture of that in the very first session, and so I thought I'd just run through some of the different records we find here, the documentation that we have. The most Tapiero was not in the database, but in this case, if I typed it right, there's an HM Pinafore set that was issued, and here they documented some of the performers, and they put the gramophone matrix numbers, I hope the hell that's what they are, over here in the legacy data, and we'll probably move that up to this field right here, import number, import company, and import number. That was one thing I wanted to show you. I have 5 minutes? The tantalizing and most frustrating part of the data you see here is not my typing, but if I can search, you can sort of do a Boolean search here, and this is the only way I know how to find this record without remembering how it's misspelled. And we do constrain request. And these, which are the XXX series, which are auditions. So here you have, without a date, but we'll find it in the ledgers, the Gershwin Trio. And as I said, I couldn't remember how the legacy data had Gershwin spelled. Gershwin Trio made about, I think it's three or four masters, about 1921, I don't remember exactly. And those recordings are the ones probably don't exist, but we're going to document all of them. There's an awful lot more I want to show you. I'm not going to show you any more in the database, I don't think, but I do want to just point out some things. These are the ledgers for electrical transcriptions, the Skippy Program 1, which is 3. We're all literally being in maybe some database things. I wanted to show you the orchestra recording. Of course, the data says it's Pryor's band, but of course, the data says it's Pryor's band, but of course, the data says it's Pryor's band, but of course, it's just a generic lot. This is sort of one of my top Sousa orchestra playing on. Not only wasn't there, but Bob and when Victor made an enormous recordings of Chinese Zumba. This is, and they're made in, we performers are, S.H. Dudley, it's not them. I think this is Jack and Jill. Called. Anyway, things that you said to do, sort of do, as a book, these would be, the many others. This is 8 things to. I'll show you the actual writing things. He's been if we stole and cover ourselves and country adding if you have a but that's I think very Ted this week get the things in any case. Oh no, hop in me.
California.
It's a privilege. Difficulties with the data. I'm in all. I'm shift Ted.
I did see him from 1960. Dad introduced. I'm interested in the video. Thank you.